Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last week, Mecklenburg County released its State of Housing Instability and Homelessness Report for 2025. It contains lots of numbers, lots of statistics, but several key takeaways include the fact that low-cost rental housing is disappearing. The number of cost-burdened renters is on the rise. Homelessness continues to be a challenge, and the combination of high rent and not enough affordable housing make existing racial and economic inequalities worse. In fact, the report says more than 77% of the low-cost housing stock available just 10 years ago is gone. So what else does the State of Housing Instability and Homelessness report tell us? What does it tell us about ourselves, and are there solutions to these problems to be found in the pages of that report? This hour, we take a closer look. Marianne Priester is Housing and Homelessness Data and Research Coordinator for Mecklenburg County. She joins us along with Lori Thomas, Executive Director of the Charlotte Urban Institute and Regional Data Trust, and Liz Clayson Kelly is CEO of Roof Above. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. So, Marianne, I'm starting with you. I know that Lori Thomas and Liz Clayson Kelly both contributed their time and their efforts to this report and their added knowledge to it as well. But tell me how all of this comes together every year. How is this report produced?
Well, through a partnership with the Urban Institute, they really developed the framework that created this report in 2018. And that work was led by Urban Institute until 2022 when it transitioned to the county. And now we use the framework that was established and attempt to build on it each year, integrating additional data and creating more comprehensive information for the community to act on through this report.
And we're going to go through some of the, not all of it, but we'd be here for all day, but we're going to go through some of the findings in this report as we go through this hour. But what happens, Marianne, to this information once the report is produced? How is it used? Or does it just sit on the shelf someplace?
I mean, I think it's broadly used in our community, not only by elected officials and providers in our community, but also community stakeholders that are looking to advocate in the housing and homelessness space. I've heard it be considered a reference guide. So it's not light reading that people are sitting around on a Saturday afternoon with coffee taking a look at, but people really use it as a reference source to get the most up-to-date information about housing and homelessness in our community.
I agree with you. Having read through big chunks of it yesterday, it is not light reading. Liz, you are on the front lines of this challenge every single day. Without getting into the minutia of the statistics in this report and what it reveals, what did you learn from this, or what do you learn from this every year that you didn't already know?
Yeah, so I do read this on a Saturday with coffee. I guess that's the kind of person I am. I get to review it every year. And it's because I do this work on the front lines, it's so meaningful to see the data that's helping explain what we're seeing. And one of the things I really like about this framework, and it was a very intentional decision by our community, is it's looking at homelessness and housing together. Because for a long time, we've thought about homelessness as an individual issue, and we're starting to understand it much more as what occurs within our housing context. And so when I look at things like what's considered the housing wage and the increase in the housing wage, and if you've highlighted the disappearance of low-cost housing, that really helps me understand what we're seeing at the front doors of our shelters and our day services center, which is increasing demand for our services.
And Laurie, the Urban Institute has been contributing to this year after year, helping to conduct research for this and other data reports. And you've spent a lot of your professional career doing this as well. You not only help gather and keep the data collected on homelessness, you also examine the effectiveness of efforts to make a dent in the problem. So are we making headway?
Yeah, so thank you, Mike. It's really good to be here and be back after 10 years. I would say, we are continuing the hard work of housing people every day, the services that go into it, but it's really hard to keep up with the lack of affordable housing that allows people to exit homelessness. And then actually, the lack of affordable housing pushes people into homelessness. And so we can be working and running as fast as we can every day, all day. And I do think our community is doing that. And if we don't actually address that larger picture, that bigger housing picture, like Liz said, we can't make headway. It's really hard to make headway. And so we can do as good as we can. And a lot of the research that we've done at the Urban Institute that I've done as a faculty member, a lot of that research points to things that we can improve in the process. But really, this is at its base, at its core, it is a housing issue. And until we really start to address that, the affordable housing shortage in this community, we're going to continue to struggle with making headway.
It's a housing issue, but as we will see as we go through the hour, there's a lot of different components to this that make it a housing issue, and it's very intertwined, and we'll get into that in a second. I know about the point in time survey that is conducted every year, and I don't think we have the results of the latest one yet because it was just recently conducted, Marianne. But aside from the point in time survey, where you essentially take a census of people who are homeless, where do you get the data for this report?
We pull from our homeless management information system, which has over 45 organizations, 120 programs that serve people experiencing housing instability and homelessness, entering data into it each year, as well as the American Community Survey. We are able to get data from our partners at CMS, the City of Charlotte, and Livian. This year, we've added data from Habitat for Humanity on critical home repair. And so those have kind of been our base data sources for years, but each year we're looking to expand that to be able to provide more comprehensive information to the community.
And Liz, data collection is happening at every level, it seems, and more and more and more so in recent years. And I know that, Laurie, you wanted to talk about the ethical way in which this data is compiled and used. What does that mean?
Yeah, so a part of this ongoing partnership, and I've worked closely with Liz and Marianne over the years. Marianne is actually a board member of the Charlotte Regional Data Trust. The Data Trust is an integrated data system that links data across service sectors and silos so that we can begin to see where there are gaps in services and opportunities to do better work together. And those data are, it's called administrative data. So they are data that are collected just to do regular operations in an organization. When someone comes and signs up for services, that's administrative data. And so we are able to actually link those data across service silos. And it's really important to understand that those data points are people, they represent people. And I think what we have done at the Data Trust is really focus in on having many stakeholders at the table, including people whose lives are represented in those data, and having them help us understand the data better, help, have us really understand better questions to ask of the data. So we do something we call participatory governance, which means that it is multiple stakeholders at the table helping us make decisions as an organization about how we use those data. And one of the key ways that we've used the data over the past 10 years is in this partnership with Mecklenburg County, when we've been able to link homeless management information system data that Marianne referred to that has I think over 40 partners in it now. So it's a large and complex data set. We've been able to then link that to data at the sheriff's office, at DSS, at the school system. And just by looking at how those data overlap, we're better able to understand how people are being served.
Is it disconnected from personal information? In other words, I know that during the point in time survey, you actually have volunteers to go out and speak directly to people who are homeless, and they're voluntarily giving you information about themselves and how they got into the situation that they're in. But is that data and other data that is part of this somehow separated from individuals so we don't have
An
invasion of privacy.
We only ever do research on de-identified data. And there are a lot of protections in place to make sure those data can't be re-identified in any way. So that's something that we think about, you know, every day at the Data Trust, trying to make sure. And I know Marianne and the county thinks about that too. Liz thinks about it too. These data are really important to protect.
So Go ahead.
Well, I think to this point of ethical, right? There's another side of this, which is, I think curiosity is so important. It's important that we bring to individuals. It's also important that we bring to the issue of homelessness. But one of the things I appreciate, the county has helped the database be very useful to the operations of service providers. So it's like how we assign beds at our emergency shelters and how we check people in is all done through this database. But then it's used to pull this de-identified data, but it is personal when it's in the database. What that means is we can share data between agencies if the person agrees. So that keeps someone from having to tell their story time and time again. It helps with more efficient data collection for the community, but it's also less traumatic for the individual. So I think we think ethically at different levels of this data process.
People in Charlotte have been talking about this, and the city of Charlotte and others have been working on this problem for years now. Millions of dollars have been devoted to this for years now. And this report clearly points out that what we have is a problem of wage inequity, a lack of affordable housing, and an increasing number of homeless people as a result of all of this. Is this, Liz, purely regional or local? Or is this happening? Are we a microcosm of what's happening nationwide?
Oh, we're actually doing better than some cities nationwide. So this is really, the federal numbers are more devastating than our local numbers. And I'm from East Tennessee. I'm from a town called Kingsport, Tennessee, which, you know, there were no signs of homelessness outside one veteran who was outside when I was a kid, right? Because in East Tennessee, housing was affordable. Like, I've seen my hometown change. They're creating homeless service provision in East Tennessee. And so it's not just a city issue anymore. We're seeing increases in more rural areas, more suburban areas, you know, regionally, places like Gastonia and Belmont are struggling with this issue. And so we certainly have unique pieces to our local issue, but this is really a national question about the role of housing in our lives, how housing's provided, the role of the marketplace in that housing provision.
The Urban Institute and the Charlotte Regional Data Trust, they've been bringing this data together, and it used to be evidently siloed. You have a tranche of information over here and another piece over here, and nobody spoke in between. And you've been working to bring all that data together so that it can be used, and you've been doing that for about a decade now, if I understand this correctly. And among the things that have been learned in that time is that someone who has been homeless in the past is at greater risk of being homeless again, and that people who identify as Black represent the largest racial and ethnic group experiencing homelessness. About 75% of the homeless population in Charlotte is Black, and that disability is also pervasive throughout all of this. I want to talk about that and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Housing Instability and Homelessness Report, which was just released last week, which gives you a little snapshot of where we are with that problem and what the root causes of it happen to be. And we're talking about it with Liz Clayson-Kelly, CEO of Roof Above. Laurie Thomas is Executive Director of the Charlotte Urban Institute and Regional Data Trust. And Marianne Priester is Housing and Homelessness Data and Research Coordinator for Mecklenburg County. And I threw out some statistics a second ago, Marianne, that if you've been homeless in the past, you have a better chance of being homeless in the future as well. That 75% of our homeless population in the Charlotte region is Black, and that disability is pervasive in among the people who are homeless. How have government and philanthropic organizations been able to use that information to have an impact on the problem?
I think that government, and I hope philanthropic foundations as well, use these data to really drive decision-making about what the funding priorities should be and where funding should be directed or realigned to better address the issues that we're seeing.
And this data comes together in large part because, Laurie, there has been a formal partnership between the Urban Institute and the Charlotte Regional Data Trust, and that, I'm told, is about to end. Since it's obviously been valuable, why?
Well, I think it's just transitioning. That started. We had actually done the So the partnership actually began as a part of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing Coalition. So that was 2010. I think it was quite some time ago. I was actually really new to UNC Charlotte and Charlotte at the time. And we came together because we recognized that came together with the county. Stacey Lowery was leading at the time. And we really recognized that we didn't have the right data to actually lead our community in good decision making, like Marianne was stating. And so this partnership actually evolved to create the integrated data reports that you mentioned some of the findings from, the state of housing instability and homelessness you mentioned that we're talking about today, as well as the dashboard that the county runs on housing stability and homelessness. So we, over that 10 years, we created 22 different reports. We incubated the large report that we're talking about today and the website for the county and transitioned that back to the county two or three years ago. And I think it's important to note there was no one assigned to data in our community in 2010. And I remember, working with the Housing Coalition and just pointing out that Knoxville, Tennessee had three full-time folks working on homelessness data, and we had no one. And so really part of what happened is the county has developed the capacity to do this work. And so we don't need to do work where county has the capacity to do it. So we're transitioning that. We will continue to work with the county as we need to, and as new projects developed. We, like I said, Marianne is a part of the Charlotte Regional Data Trust Board. So we're always thinking about ways to use these data together. It's just the transition, it's just the right time to transition this partnership.
So let's dig into some of the details. One of the findings in this latest report is that housing instability is widespread and, quote, increasingly affects households across a broader range of incomes. Laurie, explain what that means. Why is this happening?
Yeah, so what we are seeing is affordability, the rental cost burden, which essentially means that you're paying more than 30% of your income each month on rent. We're seeing that affect more and more moderate income families and not just the lower income families. And so we see a number of metrics that tell us that these moderate income families are also beginning to struggle a little bit more than they had before. Of course, we also know that those in the lowest income continue to struggle. And we have, I was going to look up my numbers here, but we have a 47% increase in cost burden households since 2014. So households are actually paying more than they should be paying for their rent, and it's creeping up into the moderate income households as well. And you know, the other you had mentioned, I think the other really just stunning statistic for me, for all of us, is the amount that you would need to earn per hour to actually afford a one bedroom apartment in Charlotte Mecklenburg. And you would actually need to earn $31.67 an hour in order to afford a fair market rent.
Let's get in. I was going to get into that much later, but let's get into it now since you brought it up. There's something called the housing wage. And this report shows there was a steep increase in just 1 year, from 2024 to 2025, up 19% in terms of what it takes to afford a one bedroom unit at fair market rates. That wage rose. Last year, you would have needed $26.62 an hour in wage to be able to afford that. This year, it's $31.67. That went up in 1 year. Minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour, which is less than I made on the radio in 1973, which means that you have to work 25 hours a day to afford that rent. That's not possible. So what types of jobs fall under that $31.67 an hour wage level? Who are those people? I can tell you. You're looking at me like I haven't read the report, but I have. It has fast food workers, janitors, nursing assistants, bus drivers, firefighters, construction workers. That actually surprised me. Social service workers, electricians, and of course, teachers.
Yes.
What are we to take from this?
Yes, I think one of the most powerful charts in that report is on page 34, where it lists all of those wages, and then it lists the housing wage for a one bedroom and the $35 housing wage for a two bedroom at the top. And then at the very bottom, you see where our minimum wage is. And you just, I mean, to me, it's just such a stark reminder that the math doesn't add up. No matter what services we provide, we have to address the math. The math doesn't work for families and for individuals who are, working. It's not just, you know, kind of the stereotype we have of folks. It's for folks who are working, the math doesn't work.
And when you look at the minimum wage, and when you look at these figures that you have to have in order to be in a one bedroom apartment at fair market rate, that's not working. And the cost of housing is not working. Liz, between 2015 and 2024, the share of low cost rentals under $800 a month, which is what that salary pays for, adjusted for inflation, dropped from 36% of housing to 8% of housing, from 76,000 available units to just under 18,000 available units. That's a loss, according to this report, of 77% of low-cost housing in just 9 years. Is what's driving this the reality of simple market forces? It's just that's what the rent will get. Is it government policy? What is it? And in view of that, where does the onus lie on turning things around?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to dig into there.
Yes, there is.
I think what's really, what people don't realize, when we think affordable housing, we think government provided housing, or I think most people do. What this report shows us is actually 10 years ago, the market was providing the vast majority of affordable units, right? It's a fancy, like older apartments rented for less in Charlotte, right? And that provided a lot of working families an ability to secure housing at affordable rates at 30% of their income. So Charlotte is growing. We're a prosperous city. People want to move here. Our housing has not kept up with our population growth. That makes us ripe for outside investment for people to come in and invest in housing because there's an opportunity here. I've already said I'm from East Tennessee. I love living in a city that is prosperous and growing. There are so many gifts to that, but there's a shadow side to that. And this data is showing us that shadow side, right? The market is not able to provide for the needs of households. Now, what that means to families, it doesn't just because things aren't affordable, doesn't mean people are suddenly homeless. Housing is incredibly valuable in someone's life. It's the foundation that all of us, right, hold dear to. For most of us, housing is the number one expense in our budget every month. What this means is that families are willing to pay well over 30% of their income on rent. What that means is when there's a job loss, a health crisis, a divorce, the death of a loved one, suddenly there's a lot less fat in your budget to protect yourself. And so it makes the loss of housing far more likely when you're spending well over 30% of your income.
We've talked about this before on with you and other people on this program, that when you're spending more than 30% of your annual income on housing, you have become a cost burden when it comes to housing. And this report shows that the majority of renters, and this is a shocking figure, the majority of renters earning less than $75,000 a year are cost burdened. I think that would surprise a lot of people, because $75,000 a year, people would not consider you poor at that level. And this is increasing among those making between $50,000 and $75,000 a year. What signal is that sending?
I say that's the chart that keeps me up at night, right? And I work in nonprofit, right? So we have the awkward reality of being roof above and looking at the housing wage and knowing what we pay in nonprofit work and recognizing that the very people working on the front lines to serve people experiencing homelessness are also struggling to afford housing in our community. We recently had the snowstorm, right? And the ice storm back to back. One of the things I realized is we have staff living in Concord, Salisbury, Gastonia. So many of our staff members are living outside the city to afford housing. We needed to come in and work on the front lines in the snow. So we were providing hotels nearby because it was difficult. And it was just a reality to me. I kind of knew that, right? But when I was fielding the phone calls from staff saying, I can't get back to Monroe, I was recognizing, wow, this is really different than even 5 years ago.
So we have this problem of housing becoming increasingly more expensive and the number of affordable housing units decreasing and the incomes not keeping up with what is needed to afford a reasonable home. And this is happening all at once. The city has been, I know you're with the county, Marianne, but the city has been working on this for years, and we have floated millions of dollars in affordable housing bonds over time. Is it working? Is it not working?
I mean, the city has certainly added a significant number of units for people earning less than 80% of AMI, but that 51 to 80% AMI range is where the majority of units has been focused. And we have the largest gap in our community, 32,601 unit gap for people earning less than 30% AMI. So what the data in this report suggests is that perhaps we might need to focus more resources and projects on meeting the needs of that 30% AMI and below group of people, because there are not units available for them to rent, and they are going to be cost burden out of the gate because there are not units that they can actually afford in our community.
And here's something else I read in the report that I have never thought about before, but it makes perfect sense. If an individual is trying to prioritize their spending and trying to be smart about where they put their money, they don't always buy the most expensive item that they can afford. It could be a TV set, it could be a car, it could be whatever. But it also includes what they're willing to pay for housing. There are people who don't always rent the housing that they can afford. They rent down. They don't pay as much. The problem with that is it's pricing people who cannot afford anything more than what they're renting down to. that they don't have availability of housing. How big is that problem, Marianne?
I mean, only 20% of people earning less than 30% of AMI were able to rent a unit that was affordable to them in 2024. So what that means is that when people that at the very lowest end of the income spectrum are unable to rent a unit, they end up renting up, becoming cost burden, but then that also contributes to the gap in the next income level up and the next income level up. And so what you and Liz were just talking about, that increase in cost burden around that group that's making between 50 and 75K, that is essentially a ripple effect from a lack of affordable housing, because when people rent up and people rent down, we end up not having enough units across the income spectrum.
One of the things that you measure through data collection is the number of people who have become homeless for the first time. That number was up 11% from fiscal year 2023 to 2024. Liz, how does that compare to previous years? Is it a steeper incline, or are we leveling off? Where are we?
It was a steeper incline in first-time homelessness. There's different ways we measure homelessness. Overall homelessness was fairly stagnant, but first-time homelessness saw an increase. We also saw unsheltered homelessness. Those are two areas where we saw pretty steep increases.
So honestly, where do most of these people end up? Did they end up on the streets? Did they end up in shelters? How many people in raw numbers are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, that gets to something which I've talked with you about on this show before, which is there's all these people we're not counting, which is often when people lose their housing for the first time, the first place they go is doubled up with friends and family or to a hotel. So we have thousands of households, thousands that we are not capturing in this report. So this report is really with homelessness data, looking at who's in our shelter, who is sleeping outside or someplace unfit for human habitation or in transitional housing. And so there is a much wider universe of housing, of what I would argue is homelessness, but doesn't necessarily get measured by the federal government as homelessness.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would just add to that, Mike, you know, we released our new numbers this morning, 2,678 people experiencing homelessness, but that is like the minimum. We know that is an undercount. Those are only people that we are touching or that we know about or that are not that are seeking services. So I think that's really important context, that this is not the overall number. This is the best number that we have, but it is a minimum number of people.
Marianne Priesters with Mecklenburg County. Laurie Thomas is here from the Charlotte Urban Institute, and Liz Clayson Kelly with Rupa. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Housing Instability and Homelessness Report, which was released last week, with Marianne Priester, Housing and Homelessness Data and Research Coordinator with Mecklenburg County. Liz Clayson Kelly is CEO of Roof Above, and Laurie Thomas is Executive Director of the Charlotte Urban Institute and Regional Data Trust. Laurie, we've been talking about all these reasons that people find themselves homeless, and the fact that homelessness is rising. First-time homelessness is rising. Evictions are up. The number of affordable units is declining. Wages aren't keeping up with the need for the amount of money you need to pay rent. Do first-time homeless folks see this coming? And if they see it coming, is there a place for them to turn so it doesn't come?
Yes, well, I'll start that, and then I'm going to pass that to Liz. So I would say yes. These families know that they are they're concerned that the money will not hold out to keep them in their housing situation. I think there are instances, medical debt, death of a loved one, where those folks are the reason a person has stable housing, that those sources of income can go away. So there are some shocks that can lead to a more sudden onset of homelessness. But for the most part, people have been struggling for a long time and trying to figure out how to make the ends meet. And so when the rent eats first, people are really aware of that process. I don't know, Liz, if you would add anything to that, but.
Well, I think to say there are systems in place and programs to try to help people. Obviously, there's still thousands of people falling between those gaps. But of course, crisis assistance is our primary place to help people with rent. But almost none of those 2,600 people that Marianne mentioned are coming directly from an apartment to homeless services. We see almost everyone goes first to natural supports, to families, to friends, to other avenues. And so that 2,600 are people who have really burned bridges or struggled. And that's where we often see, you mentioned the numbers of people with a disability experiencing homelessness. What we recognize is there's a wide range of people experiencing housing instability, and it's those with the highest vulnerabilities that typically end up turning to our homeless services system.
And these are the people that we've talked about in the past who are okay until something unexpected happens. They're one crisis or one accident away from not being able to afford all the needs, the necessaries in their life. The challenge of those working to improve the lives of those who are homeless and facing housing instability is to get them back into housing and to help them stay there. Laurie, if you experience an increase in the number of new homeless, let me put this to Liz, I'm sorry. If we are experiencing, and we are, an increase in new homeless people, you're also dealing with the people you're trying to get back into housing who have been homeless for some time. How does the arrival of new people into that inventory impact your ability to help anybody?
Yes, we are in a boat that has a hole, and we're like, you know, paling out the water, and that matters, but also being able to prevent homelessness really matters, right? And so we can't think about this as an issue that has one solution. So we have to be thinking about prevention. Prevention is about helping people keep, you know, the housing they have, but it's also about protecting that low-cost housing you mentioned. The report highlights the Housing Impact Fund, which I think is one of the most creative things happening nationwide to try to hold on to older apartments, keeping rents around $1,000. I remember when $1,000 was really high. Right now, right? That's a gift if you can find an apartment that rents for less than $1,000. So what are we doing to protect that housing stock? Because then that really reduces that housing instability. And then as people come to our system, how do we meet them at the front door to try to divert them, right? The best time to get someone out of homelessness is the first day they appear at the shelter and say, is there an alternative? How can we get you there? But if people are receiving our services in our shelter, what are the right housing solutions so we're moving people out? We got to be working at all three levels.
And this report says very clearly, preventing first-time homelessness is essential to achieving sustained reductions in homelessness. Liz has already talked about some of the things that we have in place to help that happen, Laurie, but do you have specific data on who may be on the edge so that you can step in before they become homeless?
Yeah, I think, and Marianne can speak to this too. I think, again, those folks who are doubled up, those folks, and particularly those folks who are in hotels, I think that's and then those folks who are close to eviction, who we know that are, you know, 15, 30 days out from losing the housing that they have. So those folks are on the closest edge to homelessness are those folks that it's effective where we should be applying our prevention efforts. And I think Marianne might have more specific numbers about that, but.
Marianne?
Yeah, I mean, I will just, you know, to piggyback off of what Liz said, the county has made a significant effort to develop a coordinated prevention system over the past year and a half in Mecklenburg County, recognizing this as a priority, that we have to pause the inflow into our system to make any type of measurable reductions. And that has involved bringing more partners to the table across sectors. And so those resources are really helping people that are calling and are unstable and needing assistance to stay where they are. But I think the other thing that we need to think about is critical home repair and the essential role that that plays in preventing homelessness as well, because we have people that are losing their homes because they're unable to make repairs because they cannot afford it. There's also a significant number of people, as Lori mentioned, that are living in hotels, and yet we do not have any resources that consider hotels housing, and therefore we're not able to prevent their eviction, but they're living in hotels because there's a lack of affordable housing. So like Liz mentioned, I think what this report has done so beautifully over the years is just highlight that this is a continuum from housing instability to homelessness to housing. And we really have to have strategic alignment across each sector of that continuum to be able to get people to be stably housed in affordable units in our community.
Lori, I think you wanted to add to that.
Well, I was just going to note that once we are able, one of the things that we saw in the homeless prevention study is once we were able to provide rental assistance to a family, less than 1% of those folks returned to homelessness within that next year. And so those kind of front end, just to piggyback on what Mary Ann's saying, those kind of front end preventing folks from flowing into homelessness is really important.
Liz.
And I might just add to say, I think our community has done a good job setting up programs and structures. Almost none of them are at the scale that we need. And so we see these practices that are working, but we're constantly having to make decisions about who gets the shelter bed, who gets this prevention assistance. But the outcomes of these programs are solid, right? They're effective, but we haven't been able to scale to the level of need because the need has dramatically increased over the years.
So we have about 7 minutes left, and I have a lot of territory to cover. So let's go into the lightning round, shall we? At first, Mary Ann, there appears to be some good news in this report. It states that, quote, 25% of people in emergency shelters, transitional housing, and rapid rehousing exited to permanent housing in 2024. But that number was down 4% from the previous year and 13% from 2020. So maybe it's not so good. What does this tell you, these facts and figures?
I mean, the reason that we are seeing fewer people exit the permanent housing is that there is a lack of affordable housing for them to exit to. And then also, despite ordinances being passed by the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, while we have seen decreases, we still see source of income discrimination where landlords are unwilling to take people that have vouchers or subsidies. So there really is a limited, even more narrow supply of affordable units to people trying to exit homelessness, particularly those that are using subsidies or any type of rental assistance.
So as the cost of housing rises, coupled with the decrease in the availability of affordable housing, this means longer stays in shelters, Lori, longer periods on the street, more difficulty in getting people back into permanent housing and keeping them there. And now another fly in the ointment. This is occurring as the Trump administration is de-emphasizing housing first, which is an approach that prioritizes providing permanent housing to folks so that homeless individuals can pursue other goals and rebuild their lives. How widespread and or successful or impactful has the housing first approach been in Charlotte? And what does de-emphasizing that approach mean?
Yeah, so I think I have had the privilege of both working with the county with Liz and really being able to study the effectiveness of Housing First in our community, both first through Moore Place, then through the Housing First Charlotte-Mecklenburg initiative, which housed over 1,000 people, 70% of which remained housed after 2 years. Really, the preponderance of evidence around the effectiveness of Housing First is widespread. It really is the intervention that we know focusing on housing works. We know focusing on housing works.
And when it's not just you, it's people who what you do across the country. So has a reason been given by the Trump administration for that wanting to end or de-emphasize this housing first approach? And if so, do you understand the reasoning?
Yeah, so here's what I will speak to on that. I do think I cannot speak to the Trump administration and how they're reasoning this, but what I will say is I think it's hard for folks to understand when they still see people on the street, when they still see and know that people are experiencing homelessness. It's hard to think, well, is that thing actually working? And so I think it's important to know that what we've been dealing with is just a vast housing shortage. And actually, while I can understand the administration wanting to focus on providing services, the way that they're actually suggesting us focusing on services takes us back many years and many decades in how we were providing services to things that are just evidentially not as effective. And so it is I won't say it's settled science because science is always evolving, but it is absolutely, there's evidence that has just accumulated across the country, across the world, that actually focusing on housing is the most effective way. That doesn't mean housing only. I think that's important to state too, and I think that's part of what folks have focused in on is it's housing only, and that's not the case.
So there is some good news here, and I want to focus on something good before we end this conversation, Liz, and that is that veterans are gaining access to housing. Why? How is that happening?
Well, I want to end on hope, Mike Collins. So I want to say one thing, and then I'm going to answer your veteran
Okay, all
question.
right.
So when you look at this report, the hardest data, like the most depressing data, is about our housing and the fact that our homelessness is fairly stagnant in light of this changing housing context. Gives me hope that all the work we're doing, the ways the public and private sector are working together, are working. We see this nowhere better than in veteran homelessness. Nationally, locally, veteran homelessness has been slashed in half in just the last several years. I think 7 years at Marianne and Charlotte-Mecklenburg, veterans homelessness has been cut in half. Veterans homelessness is the one place the federal government has really scaled investment in housing at the level that we need it. And so the federal government has come together with local communities to really prioritize ending veterans homelessness. They've put housing vouchers, significant funding for housing vouchers. We've combined that locally with great coordination. There's groups that meet together twice a month. We go name by name, individuals, veterans experiencing homelessness, saying what is the right solution. So this shows us that federal investment, large-scale housing investment combined with local coordination, really caring individual by individual, it's working. So that is, I think, the brightest spot that reminds us we know what we need to do, but it does take investment. And you mentioned starting out, we've spent millions, but I just want to remind people housing is expensive. Again, for most of us, it's our highest bill, but we pay it because we value it. And so I value a community where people have the safety and stability of housing, and
So,
we're
Liz,
working on it.
I know that you're optimistic. You have said that you believe that homelessness can end. Lori, however, says that we are at a key inflection point at the moment. And since Liz is optimistic, I want to hear from all three of you about if you are optimistic, despite this inflection point, Laurie, and if so, what's the most important thing that must be done? And I have a minute, so I'll start with you, Laurie.
Yes, the creation and preservation of housing that's affordable to the lowest and income levels.
Marianne.
I would say homelessness is absolutely solvable. We have the tools, we have programs and interventions that work. We have not enough money or resources to make that a reality. And we have relied heavily on government funding, both federally and locally, and that is insufficient to meet the need. And that's why philanthropic and corporate partnerships and corporate and philanthropic investment are so important to make this work a reality because we can't end homelessness in our community.
Liz, you're the one, you're the optimist here.
Well, the data is pointing in the wrong direction, but this is where I state my claim. We live in a community where people still understand those experiencing a housing crisis to be their neighbor. And as long as we understand that we are each other's keepers, we will and can find a way to this solution.
Liz Clayson Kelly is CEO of Roof Above. She finds herself on the front lines of this every day. Laurie Thomas is Executive Director of the Charlotte Urban Institute and Regional Data Trust. And Marianne Priester joins us. She's Housing and Homelessness Data and Research Coordinator for Mecklenburg County. If you want some light reading, I'm sure you can download the Housing Instability and Homelessness Report and spend your entire weekend going through the first five pages. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.